Hello, and welcome to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. On today's show, we'll feature a radio adaptation of an article by Chicago Indie Media's Chris Giovannis, published in the online political newsletter Counterpunch. The article is entitled, First Protect Your Vote, Lessons for Democrats on Fixing Elections from Chicago. We'll also include a summary of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. The Justice Department claims the United States can hold anyone it wants at a Guantanamo camp. Walmart auto workers look to unionize at one store. Alabama residents uphold a bigoted amendment, but a recount is underway. The CIA transferred Iraq detainees out of the country for supposed interrogation. And two TV networks refused to air a progressive church ad. Government lawyers argued in court on December 1st that U.S. civilian judges do not have jurisdiction over the detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and that special tribunals set up by the Bush administration are enough to satisfy a June Supreme Court ruling that the prisoners can challenge their detention in U.S. courts. Seeking to challenge the several petitions filed in U.S. civilian courts by Guantanamo detainees since the Supreme Court's ruling, Justice Department Attorney Brian Boyle stated that the prisoners have no constitutional rights enforceable in this court. Boyle also insisted on the president's authority to detain anyone in the world considered an enemy combatant. When asked by presiding judge Joyce Hens Green if a little old lady in Switzerland, whose donation to an Afghan orphanage ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda without her knowing it, could be arrested and held as an enemy combatant, Boyle said she could. He added, "Someone's intention is clearly not a factor that would disable the detention." Boyle said it would then be up to a military combat status review tribunal to decide whether or not to continue her imprisonment. Human rights and legal organizations have repeatedly condemned the status review tribunals for their lower standards of evidence as compared to U.S. courts and because they do not provide legal counsel to the detainees. A group of Walmart automotive service employees is taking the first step toward unionizing at a December 2nd hearing with the National Labor Relations Board. The 17 workers in the Tire and Lube Express Department of a Loveland, Colorado Walmart want to join the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7. The workers are attempting to become the second group of Walmart employees to successfully seek union representation in the company's history. In 2000, meat cutters at a Walmart in Jacksonville, Texas, voted 7-3 in favor of joining the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 540. That success was short-lived. Walmart eliminated meat cutter positions company-wide and switched to prepackaged meat within a month of the vote. The unionized butchers were offered non-union jobs in different departments. An Alabama amendment to repeal racist language from the state's constitution is undergoing a recount after it failed to pass by a very small margin during the November 2nd election. Proponents of the measure said it was merely a formality to update Alabama's constitution and bring it in line with federal laws. The amendment would remove from the constitution phrases such as, "Separate schools shall be provided for white and colored children, and no child of either race shall be permitted to attend a school of the other race," end of quote. Nevertheless, the amendment lost by a margin of 1,850 votes, a small enough percentage to automatically trigger a recount. However, since there are no reports of irregularities, most reporters do not expect the recount to change the outcome. The amendment's defeat is attributed to a stiff opposition campaign launched by conservative organizations and individuals. Opponents reportedly stirred up fears that the measure would give lawmakers the ability to raise taxes for education as a result of removing texts that denied Alabamans a right to education at the public's expense. In what international law experts call a violation of the Geneva Conventions, the U.S. Department of Justice provided the CIA with a memo justifying the secret transfer of Iraqi detainees outside the country for purposes of interrogation. According to an anonymous intelligence official familiar with the operation, who spoke to the Washington Post, the CIA has removed up to 12 Iraqi ghost detainees from Iraq since the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal broke in the media. According to the Fourth Geneva Convention, to which the U.S. is a signatory, forcible transfers as well as deportations of protected persons from occupied territory are war crimes, constituting a grave breach of the accord, regardless of their motive. The memo, a draft of which was obtained by the Washington Post, was written by the Office of Legal Counsel, which advises the administration and government agencies on the legality of policies under consideration. The same office previously stirred up related controversy when it advised the White House that torture during interrogation may be justified in the so-called War on Terror. It is not yet known where the CIA took the prisoners it transferred, or if they were brought to countries where torture is legal, since Abu Ghraib and the other prisons in Iraq already host detainment and interrogation facilities. Two major television networks have refused to air a commercial by a progressive religious group promoting the inclusion of homosexuals, disabled persons, and people of color at their churches. Both NBC and CBS cited policies that ban ads dealing with controversial issues, but the United Church of Christ has accused the networks of censorship. NBC said it rejected the 30-second ad, which shows bouncers turning away a male couple, a man in a wheelchair, and people of color from an unnamed church, because the network interprets the ad as being critical of other churches for not being open to all people. The commercial's words say, "Jesus didn't turn people away, neither do we." CBS sent a rejection letter to the United Church of Christ, which the group later released to the press. The letter reads, "Because this commercial touches on the exclusion of gay couples and other minority groups by other individuals and organizations, and the fact the executive branch has recently proposed a constitutional amendment to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman, this spot is unacceptable for broadcast." Reverend John Thomas, General Minister and President of the United Church of Christ, told the San Francisco Chronicle, quote, "It's ironic that after a political season awash in commercials based on fear and deception by both parties seen on all the major networks, an ad with a message of welcome and inclusion would be deemed too controversial," unquote. Another spokesperson for the church accused the networks of caving into political pressures. They, quote, "can't afford to go against the administration's versions of Christianity and what counts as moral values and what doesn't count as moral values," unquote. Those were the words of Reverend Kyle Lovett, pastor of St. John's United Church of Christ in San Francisco, as spoken to the Chronicle. Fox and several cable networks have agreed to run the ad. ABC runs no religious ads, but said its sister network, the ABC Family Channel, will allow the ad. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
On November 30th, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell signed a bill into law that prohibits communities from building their own free public wireless networks unless they get approval from phone giant Verizon first. Verizon's the dominant telecom provider in the state. It fears the proliferation of community wireless will cut into its revenues, even though Verizon promised 10 years ago to aggressively build a broadband network in the state but has failed to do so. The law was initially intended to stop the city of Philadelphia from starting its own municipal wireless network. Harold Feld, associate director of the Media Access Project, says the city's exempt from this new law, but in exchange, Verizon's guaranteed what's in essence a captive market for broadband in the rest of the state and sweetens its bottom line fine to the tune of some $140 million in state subsidies.
They're going to charge the people of Pennsylvania a new tax in order to pay Verizon to bring broadband out to these communities that were already, you know, funding themselves.
Governor Rendell's backing of Verizon on this issue does not come as much of a surprise to Inge Coates, founder of the Philly-based Media Tank.
He was really celebrated when he was the mayor of Philadelphia because he's kind of like Bill Clinton. You know, he represented enough liberal interests that people felt like he was an ally, but really always was very much on the side of big business. One of his former chiefs of staff is now a really high-ranking official over at Comcast.
Harold Feld thinks this new law will have a disastrous effect on smaller cities and towns in Pennsylvania. If they can't get Verizon's okay to supply ubiquitous broadband to their citizens and businesses, there's a good chance economic development will stagnate.
People have to realize how critical these services are for the 21st century. For a lot of these small communities, getting a municipal network online now makes the difference between whether you can keep your people and attract new folks and build up your economy, or whether you're going to become a ghost town because people just can't do business there anymore.
Inge Coates is disappointed by the outcome of this particular legislation, but doesn't believe it's a total loss.
Historically, these things happen and nobody even knows about it, and it just sails through. And I think now people are becoming activated on these issues and are going to have to be considered in the future.
Similar laws have already been passed in a dozen states, part of a nationwide campaign by phone and cable providers to commercialize all online access points.
As big media gets bigger, it's no surprise that minority voices and viewpoints get squeezed out of the national dialogue. But Glenn Ford, the co-publisher and editor of BlackCommentator.com, refuses to be silenced. Ford used to be a reporter for Black Radio Networks and founded the first nationally syndicated public affairs TV show for African Americans. But that was more than 20 years ago. Now, Ford says, there isn't much that passes for journalism in the mainstream media these days, black or white.
The corporate consolidation of media has resulted in a sameness and a real dumbing down of America. Americans don't know what the rest of the world looks like, what it thinks about the United States.
This consolidation has devastated black news outlets especially.
In Washington, D.C. alone, the Black Radio Press Corps numbered 21 reporters. Today, there are only 4 reporters making up the Black Radio Press Corps. About half of the stations that would fall under the category of black radio are owned by just 2 companies, Radio One out of Washington, D.C., and Clear Channel. Neither of these 2 chains even entertains the idea of doing news.
This, according to Ford, allows racism to flourish. Just look at public perception of voter disenfranchisement in the last 2 presidential elections, the victims of which were primarily black.
Michael Dawson and Lawrence Bobo, both professors at Harvard University, have found in through a series of surveys that 37% of whites believed that the abuses of black voting rights in Florida were fabrications of the Democrats. That is appalling, and we can't blame that on the media. We blame that on white racism in the society at large.
Black Commentator publishes news stories and news analysis every week, which includes a downloadable radio commentary. Visit blackcommentator.com to learn more.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Senator John McCain has introduced legislation that would bring thousands more community radio stations like this one to neighborhoods all across the country. But it won't happen unless Congress hears from you. This is a historic opportunity for us to reclaim some of the airwaves for non-commercial and local use. So call your senators and representatives now and tell them you support low-power FM radio for every community in this country. For more information, go to the Prometheus Radio Project at www.prometheusradio.org. Thank you for supporting Low Power FM Radio.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stupinczyk. On today's show, we'll feature a radio adaptation of an article by Chicago Indie Media's Chris Giovannis, published in the online political newsletter Counterpunch on November 5, 2004. The article is entitled, First Protect Your Vote, Lessons for Democrats on Fixing Elections from Chicago. There is one mantra among all others that has driven electoral work in Chicago by both machine hacks and the occasional independent campaign seeking to unseat the machine. Protect the vote. In Chicago, the grift works like this. Black and Latino voters walk into their precinct and are immediately challenged by machine poll watchers on the most trifling and often illegal pretexts, from lack of ID, which is not a legal requirement in Chicago, to manufactured improprieties in their registration. And that's exactly what happened in Ohio, where election hacks identified people based on race alone and colluded with judges to hand out, quote, provisional, unquote, ballots, the vast majority of which are never counted. Much like Halloween candy to these voters. How is this allowed to happen? Why, by controlling the judges in the polling places, who then blindly support the challenges of those poll watchers. In Chicago's wards, machine Democrats execute this by running both Democratic and Republican candidates for ward committeemen, an unpaid post whose holders have historically served as patronage bosses, but who also appoint all election judges in each ward for their respective parties. This strategy effectively allows the machine boss to ensure that the judges appointed to precincts from both parties are their people, who will follow the lead of their poll watchers when voters are challenged. And that's exactly what happened in Ohio, where Republican Party hacks tore a page from the Chicago machine's playbook and tightly controlled the dynamic inside the polling places, with predictable results. What was the Kerry campaign's response? Why, to concede the election, of course, despite their avowal to ensure that all the votes would be counted. This sure-lose strategy came on the heels of an abysmal failure on the part of the Kerry campaign, the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Leadership Council to throw resources into voter registration and turnout projects, until black leaders threw a series of fits in the closing weeks of the election and the party hacks relented, a day late and a dollar short. To battle this machine-style strategy, you need sharp poll watchers inside the polling places who know both the rulebook, including what constitutes a justifiable versus a bogus challenge, plus how to document judges' refusal to play fair, thereby laying down a paper trail to fight for the inclusion of contested or provisional ballots. The same aggressive response is required when contending with the issue of spoiled ballots, typically caused when a ballot will not correctly clear a counting machine because of a hanging chad or otherwise incorrectly punched ballot. In Chicago, spoiling ballots is a pretty simple process. An unattended machine poll watcher simply goes from voting booth to voting booth and tampers with the punch templates, often by breaking off a pencil lead in the punch hole of the candidate you want to thwart, virtually ensuring that the punch will not clear the ballot. Again, you combat these sorts of strategies by ensuring that you've got crack poll watchers inside on the case, who understand that they have the right to physically view so-called spoiled ballots, and fight for those ballots' inclusion when they can be shown to reflect a voter's intent, even when the punch tool has not completely cleared the punch slot in the ballot. You also need ace precinct workers outside, who can show voters how to check their own ballots to make sure that they are properly punched before they turn them back to the judges. But these strategies can only succeed if those poll watchers and precinct volunteers are working from plus counts, basically lists on poll sheets of canvassed voters that are based on solid door-to-door interviews and scientific voter outreach in the neighborhoods. And it's not enough to know who your plus voters are, and to fight for their right to cast regular ballots inside the polling places. You also need a party infrastructure that will fight both within the courts and election commissions, and on the ground through the mobilization of popular expression to ensure that those votes are ultimately counted, and that the final election results are modified to reflect those votes. Instead, the Kerry campaign threw in the towel before even a handful of those contested votes in those contested precincts could be counted. It also bears noting that, despite the corporate spin about the record turnout and a Bush majority, Fully 45% of eligible voters in this country simply never made it to the polls, or in many cases did and were turned away. Again, polls suggest that the majority of these voters hail from the Democratic Party's core progressive constituencies, non-white and working-class voters. Harold Washington won two elections as Chicago's first black mayor because his supporters mounted an aggressive operation that sought to turn out and protect the vote. The result? People turned out in huge numbers, and their precinct volunteers protected those votes inside the polling places, in the courts, and on the streets. Instead, in this presidential election, we have a situation that much more closely mirrors the dynamic we saw during the Reagan years, when Reagan took office twice based on a voter, quote, mandate, unquote, that was actually based on the votes from less than a third of the eligible electorate. Yeah, the fix was in, and the Kerry campaign colluded in it. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.